Good afternoon. I'm Loreto Rojas.
And I'm Cal Winslow.
Today, we continue our series in recognition of Hispanic Heritage Month. We'll present four programs in all, each considering an important issue in the Latinx community and beyond.
And this afternoon's guest is Alvaro Huerta, an associate professor in urban and region planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona.
Professor Huerta reaches the intersecting domains of urban planning, Chicano, Chicana, Latino studies, immigration, religion, social movements, social networks, and the informal economy. Huerta is author of the award-winning book, Latino Immigrant Communities in the Xenophobic Era of Trump and Beyond. This book was published in 2019.
And he's received numerous awards for his social, racial justice and civic engagement, such as the Association of Collegiate Schools of Planning, their 2016 Edward E. Blakely Award, and the American Planning Association's 2011 National Planning Leadership Award.
Alvaro was born in the U.S. He was raised in the Mexican Colonia Libertad in Tijuana, Baja California, and an American barrio, Ramona Gardens Public Housing Project, or also known as the Big Hazard Projects in East Los Angeles. As a first generation elementary school, high school, and university graduate, he holds a PhD in city and regional planning from UC Berkeley, one of the first Chicanos to do so. He also holds an MA in urban planning and a BA in history from UCLA.
So welcome back again. Very welcome indeed. Can we call you Alvaro?
Yes, please do so.
Yes. Well, let's just finish out your CV here with one more thing. We see you've just been appointed a fellow in religion and public life at the Harvard Divinity School. So congratulations. And can you tell us a bit what's up there?
Well, thank you very much to both of you. This is a great program. I'm very excited to be with y'all. Yes, I'm currently at Harvard, and I'm teaching and mentoring graduate students at the Harvard Divinity School, focusing on issues that have to do with religion, social movements, immigration, and community organizing in Latino and Latina communities.
So, Alvaro, you're not using the Latinx, so present everywhere. You know, I hesitate to use Latinx because it's hard to translate into Spanish. Do you think it's something more like generational or?
Yes, I think so. In the 1950s, the Mexican-Americans that served in the war, many of them were conservative. So their kids in the 60s started to rebel against them. So they were saying, no, we're not Mexican-Americans, we're Chicanos or Chicanas. So I see this Latinx as a generational question, where each generation proclaims their own identity. What I do with young people, I mean, I have a son who's a senior at Amherst College. His name is Joaquin, and he's at that generation. He's 22 years old. I see a lot of people that are older. They make negative comments to the youth that use that term, and I don't believe in that. I think every generation should determine their own identities and their own future. So if someone wants to call themselves Latinx or Chicanox, I think that's fantastic. For me, it's a question of, I'm more used to using those terms that I use now. And that evolved, because at first it was Latino. I would just say Chicano, and then I would say Latino. I wouldn't include Latina or Chicana. So I evolved myself to make sure to include not just the male, because as you know, like in Spanish, it's you say los abuelos. And los abuelos is it includes both the abuela and abuelo, but you say mis abuelos. So, so I understand that in the sexist nature of language, but I see more that X as a generational issue, and I support it. But because I'm not of that generation, I just don't use it. Maybe later on, you know, I'll adopt it. But for now, I support what young people do and others that embrace it as well.
One more thing, maybe before we get into the heart of this interview, I see we're not the first radio program to host you. You've done others, I guess, including the TED Hour, it says here, and that your talks I've seen are about those at the bottom. I wondered if you could explain that, both in terms of how you feel about being on the radio, and two, about talking about those on the bottom.
Right. Yeah, I'm very comfortable. I've been a public figure for many years. I have two TEDx talks, and I'm always open and willing to talk to people at all levels, whether it's a juvenile hall, whether it's a university, whether it's a radio or podcast. I feel any program that is disseminating good information to help the public good is something that I support, like both of you who are doing great work in helping communities. For me, someone asked me that question before, and what I tell them is, I once said that I started at the bottom. It's kind of like Drake when he says, started from the bottom, now I'm at the top, that rap song. And people say, well, why do you say that? Why do you say you started at the bottom? And I tell them, I go, well, when you grew up in a slum like I did in Tijuana, where there was no running water. Actually, I don't even like the word slum, because the people that live there are beautiful and very industrious, and they build their own homes, and they're amazing people. But in terms of like the conditions were slum conditions, you know, this is the first 4 years of my life, even though I was born here in the United States. I'm like what Republicans call an anchor baby. So when you start off in abject poverty, the water's contaminated. There's no toilet in the house. It's outside, dirt roads. Like you see the images of like in India, things of that nature. This is the people. This is kind of where I come from. Not at the severe poverty in India. That this is different level. The poverty in India is a little more severe than Mexico. And then coming to being raised in housing projects in East LA, where it's not just about poverty, but also violence, like literally constantly worrying about being assaulted or being shot or being killed. And I'm not even talking about the gang members, I'm talking about the police. So the violence. So when a lot of times when you start at the bottom and when you're there, and what I tell people is like when you're poor and Mexican and everybody else is poor Mexican, you don't even know that you're poor Mexican, you know, because you think that's normal. You know, like when I was growing up in the projects, like 99% of the, like 100% of the residents were Mexican origin. And we had railroad tracks, we had freeways, factories. And when I went to UCLA in 1985, I was 17 years old and, as a math major, I didn't realize how beautiful like places can be. I didn't know that they were like, how there were communities without these things, you know, that were harmful. And then I started to realize that the people who lived in different places were having helicopters roam around your home, you know, was not common. So that was like a culture shock to me. Most people have culture shocks when they go to university because they're the first ones. But for me, it was different. It wasn't just about your first one. It was like you're going to places where you don't see that. And then you realize like, oh my God, I grew up poor, because I didn't realize, I wasn't thinking that I grew up poor because everybody else was poor.
Right. You know, yeah. So. You're reminding me when I came to the States and I couldn't believe that almost any faucet I will open will have hot water. I was like, what? Have hot water everywhere? I mean, water already was like a commodity. So yeah.
Yeah. No, one time I went to meet, when my grandma died and abuelita died in Michoacán, I went to Morelia, and you take a shower, there's a bucket of water there. And then all of a sudden the water turns off and you're like, where's the water? But there's a bucket, you're supposed to use that bucket. And I didn't know, you know, it's things that those of us who were raised here, because I was predominantly raised here, even though I spent 4 years in Tijuana, we take for granted that not everybody lives in a home or an apartment where there's running water or there's hot water, cold water.
So Alvaro, you know, with this introduction of your background and perhaps a little bit of my own, I wanted to ask you about housing, because, you know, this is one of the, during the pandemic, I think we have, a friend of mine was saying that she feels that the pandemic has been a huge light that has highlighted all our lives the way they are, particularly essential workers and poor people. And one of the things that we are all seeing everywhere in California, I believe, and many places in the world, is that we have having this issue with housing where there is not enough homes for people. So your PhD is in related to this topic. So I wanted to ask you a little bit to talk about how we can justify or the, you were describing this place where you grew up. So I hear now people talking about tiny houses. It makes me really upset because it's like an option for the homeless. But housing is more than just having a roof over your head, right?
Yes, it's very unfortunate in the United States where housing is not a right. It's more of a privilege. And this applies to healthcare as well. So in a way, having homeless people or having people outside of the market, it benefits those that own property and those that manage property because they can raise the rent. So if everybody has a house or an apartment, then the rate, they can be renting in Los Angeles $2,000 or $2,500 for one bedroom apartment. The only way they can do that if there's a shortage. So it's not true that we all suffer from it. That's not true. What's true is that the majority of us do, but there's a minority that don't, that benefit. And it actually sends a clear message. It's like, if you don't want to be homeless, then you're going to be forced to pay $2,500 for an apartment, a two-bedroom or one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles. In California, unfortunately, it's become very antagonistic or inhospitable for working class to just rent. Forget about buying. I mean, because it looks like in Los Angeles, it's about $650,000, like the average, to buy a home. I mean, how many people have that type of money to be able to buy a home for $650,000? And that's the average. And then you have to think about the down. So let's say they say 20% down. So that's a lot of money. How many people have, you know, over 100,000 just to put down? And then you have to have a good credit score. And then you have to have all these issues that make it very, very difficult for people to buy a home. And then for our children or our grandchildren, those of them that are in high school or college, I mean, they're burdened with student loans and student debt. So how many of those coming out of college are going to be in a position where they can buy a home? So some people or a lot of people in the 70s and 80s, they were able to buy a home, and by now it's most likely paid off. And at the time it wasn't, the interest rate was high, but the housing wasn't that expensive. So they were able to get in the market, and then now for those same people to get in the market now, it's impossible. Because there might be like a fixed income, there might be a Social Security, but the house is paid off. It's the same with college. You know, there was a time where just even myself, when I was at UCLA, started 85, I'm still looking for the registration card. I can't believe I misplaced it. It was like $472 a quarter or something like that to attend UCLA for a quarter. I mean, I got full financial aid, so I didn't have to worry about anything because I was poor. But now if you were to go there, you add a zero to that, you know, just for a quarter. So it's very, very expensive. So just to enter the housing market, you know, coming out with student debt or for any immigrant making minimum wage or below to be able to rent at the current rate is almost impossible. So what do working class people do? What do immigrants do in particular, because that's my specialty? A lot of them, they might have been in a place for many years, so their rent is not that high because of rent control, or in California, you could only raise the rent so much. So if you've been in a place for 10, 20 years, they could only raise it so much per year. So you're okay. When you leave, that's the problem, because that same house, maybe you're renting, let's say it's a two bedroom for $1,000. When you leave, now that same apartment is $2,000, $3,000. And I'm not talking about West LA or, you know, Beverly Hills, or I'm talking about regular working class neighborhoods that the prices are skyrocketing. So once people leave, those to enter that same market is almost impossible. So what a lot of people do is they pull the resources. So you'll have like a couple of one or two family members or two families living together in the same house. So you'll have the cousin, the uncle, the parent, like extended family all living in one house or one apartment to be able to afford the rent. Or maybe they bought a house in the 70s or 80s in Inglewood or another place where Wall Heights, where it wasn't that expensive, but now it is. They do have property. But typically what people do, they just pull the resources and they're able to, especially with Latinos and Latinas, is you would think that the homelessness rate, it would be higher because of the low wages. But the only reason it's not is because we have this concept of the family. So we bring people in. And in reality, those people are homeless. And I can say this, some members of my family were, technically they're homeless, but they're not homeless because they've been taken in by a family member. And without that family support, they would be on the street. So there's kind of like that social safety net that exists within the family, within the culture itself, not the government, you know, not the private sector, which we can't rely on because they're more interested in profits, you know.
And what is the government and the private sector? Well, I don't know about the private sector. Maybe they are not doing much. But what is the government doing to address this situation? I mean, we see that the not only the Latinos, but anyway, we are celebrating the Hispanic Heritage Month. So let's talk more Latinos here. That the Latinos live in these crowded places, and this is why we have been also quite impacted. But what are the policies that are being developed to address these issues? Are there any?
Unfortunately, within the government, they're complicit, and it forces a lot of. Let's just talk about Latinos and Latinas within this, because it makes more sense for me. What ends up happening? People are forced to leave the state. All right, so a lot of Latinos and Latinas, they're going to the south, like Georgia or even Texas, where it's cheaper to live, and there's a demand for that labor. And so they can buy a house or rent a house and for the same amount. The only thing they pay less, but it's just cheaper. California is just it's very expensive. Before it was just LA, San Francisco, but now it's everywhere. Sacramento, where I was born, and the San Joaquin Valley, everywhere is just very, very expensive. The government, and a lot of elected officials, whether it's the mayor of Garcetti or the governor, they're all complicit. They talk a good game, but they don't practice it. They're not interested in doing rent control across the board. They're not interested in doing anything that guarantees housing. They actually support, and even this is, it's sad to say that even Latino and Latina politicians, that they support policies where there's development from the private sector, because that means more taxes. So they'll get more taxes because of that. We see this in Chinatown, where a lot of elderly Chinese-Americans, Chinese immigrants are being displaced because there's a new development that's coming in. A building is being torn down, or they're building condos, for example. Even though they say, okay, we'll give you the first right to rent but if they're on Social Security, if they're not in a position to buy, you know, they're essentially being kicked out. So they might be given like $20,000 or something, but how long is that going to last you in Los Angeles? You know, not very long. So you see that the government itself pretty much favors development because developers, they give donations, right? So they donate to their causes, to their re-election campaigns. Unfortunately, poor people don't do that. I'm not poor anymore, but when I was poor, we didn't give money to elected officials. We didn't vote in mass. It's not that we were complacent in terms of voting. It's just that we didn't see government working for us. So we didn't see that. So why were we going to invest in something that there was no, the services that existed were poor or were inadequate or even hostile towards us in terms of the police and public housing and everything else. But I see more elected officials are more interested in their own self-interest and getting reelected and promoting developments that support a bigger tax base for them in terms of revenue. But they're not interested in living wages. They're not interested in having affordable housing or having housing as a right for everybody.
Loretta, you were going to ask about COVID.
Well, yeah, I was making this connection about, you know, people living in these small quarters and COVID. So I don't know if there is really a consideration by the authorities to change these policies that you are describing to us, Alvaro, in order to actually create more a sense of a community. And I'm going here, also going to repeat what I said earlier about these tiny houses that are sprouting around some places. I know there are not so many, but they try to make them colorful and all that. But it's really like another area that is confined. It's like I see more and more, because I grew up in Santiago de Chile, which is a huge urb. And during the 80s, you know, late 70s and 80s, the policies were just to take everybody, poor people, and push it to the peripheries, just creating these big areas of poverty and just keeping certain neighborhoods that were more exclusive. Somehow I thought that this would be different here, but even in the small towns, it seems that policy replicates again and again.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, here we try, the idea is to have poverty be segregated. And in throughout Latin America, the rich live in the hills, and here in the United States, the opposite. Right. So this, in Latin America, the poor live in the hills, the rich in the cities, and it's the opposite here. But now they're returning to the cities here in the United States. The problem with COVID, it exposed something that existed, but something that wasn't, that the mainstream media didn't pay attention to. In the case of Latinos and Latinas, for example, the case of overcrowding. So it's actually true and false at the same time that COVID impacts everybody. It's true that we're all impacted because of COVID, because rich people die as well, or get contracted and die. But what's false is that we're all impacted equally. That's not true. So what happens when Cuomo and CNN gets COVID, he goes in his garage or his basement and he's isolated. So he isolates himself, and the wife brings him food and knocks on the door and he gets. Now for the common Latino, Latina, especially immigrant in California, they don't have that luxury. So a lot of times you have, let's say you have, you know, four people living in one bedroom apartment or three people. And sometimes there's even no apartment, just a studio. So there's nowhere to isolate. So when someone gets COVID, everybody gets COVID. Because we don't have that luxury of space. Because of our wages are low on average, or lower than white Americans. So they're lower. The educational level is lower as well. So our living conditions, we live in more crowded housing, whether it's a home or an apartment, owned or a rental. And this is one reason why Latinos, the COVID rate is higher than whites in California. So right now, I'm just speaking about California. Okay, I'm sure it could be applied everywhere else, but in terms of California, it's because of the higher density in terms of the housing. And there's nowhere to isolate. So we don't have that luxury. You see a lot of affluent people where they're, I mean, we don't live that far from Beverly Hills, Bel Air, here in LA. And I mean, you have people like two people living and there's like 16 rooms or even four rooms, they're just by themselves. I mean, that to me, that's like obscene, right? But the housing situation and the living conditions exasperate the problem of COVID. So it brings it out more. Same thing with the fact that on average, Latinos and Latinas in general, and then immigrants in particular, in California and also beyond, but let's just stick to California, they have a higher rate of working in the service industry. So they're in contact with other people. So the likelihood of them getting COVID is higher than the average white American that probably has an office job where they can Zoom. I'm not saying that white people don't work in restaurants and in services, they do. But in terms of proportion, in terms of rates, so because of that, they're more exposed. So if you're working as a waitress or as a busboy, or if you're working washing cars or in cleaners, you're in contact with a lot of people. Or like my mom, you know, she was a domestic worker cleaning like different people's homes. The likelihood of you getting COVID is higher. So from the employment to the housing and the type of work that we do, that we don't have, and I say we in terms of a community, we don't have that luxury of Zooming like I do, for example, then that's when COVID kind of brings out these contradictions and it showcases the inequalities that exist in America. So that's the problem that I see with COVID. And I don't think the government is doing a good job in handling that. Like every single Latino and Latina, especially the immigrants that work in the informal economy, you don't hear about them. Like you hear about the restaurants closing, but before the restaurants closed, all the street vendors were shut down. But it's like they never existed. So this invisible labor force that we all benefit from in terms of the tacos and the hot dogs with the bacon, they were the first ones hit by COVID, but nobody talks about them except me. It may be, you know, both of you, so there's three of us.
You're right. Hey, we must pause here. This is Cal Winslow, and I'm with my co-host, Loretta Rojas. We're your host today. Our program is talking about California. And in this series, we're recognizing Hispanic Heritage Month. Today, we're talking with Alvaro Huerta, who's an associate professor of urban and regional planning at the State University Polytechnic in Pomona. This might be kind of changing subjects a bit, but I was struck by one of your titles. It's called Reframing the Latino Immigration Debate. So I wanted to ask you, what is this about? And what is the debate? What are the sides? We hear sometimes we hear a lot, sometimes not, about comprehensive immigration reform. Not so much right now. So what did you mean when you entitled your piece, Reframing the Immigration Debate?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. And the other questions, I really love your show and the questions that y'all ask. That's the title of my first book. And what I was seeing during that time period was in 2013 and before that, I was observing, and I'm sure it was just beyond my time observing it, was that every single comment on mainstream media and the politicians about immigrants was negative. And everything was very hostile. And even TV shows that I appeared on, I was being asked questions like, well, you know, we all believe in the wall, right? And we all believe in security. And I'm like, no, I don't believe in walls. You know, I think that we're all human beings. You know? I see myself as a citizen of the world. You know, I don't believe in borders, and I don't even believe in race. I mean, we're all human beings. All of us here in this Zoom and everybody, all everybody who's listening, we're all human beings first. And we all come from Africa, you know, so.
That's right.
Me, you know, so I see myself more like as a human race, you know, and embrace that. And when it comes to immigrants, I don't even like to use the word immigrant anymore, because even though I use it, I just don't like it, because it, since the beginning in this country, when it was founded on the backs of slaves and the killings of Native Americans, it's always been a dirty word. And the Anglos used it against the Germans, and then the Anglos and Germans later used it against the Italians and the Poles and the Irish. So even the other Europeans were at one point considered ethnics, and they were all, it was always negative. It was always derogatory against people of Jewish ancestry and the Italians and the Irish, and all these people were different. They were Catholic. They were non-Christian. You know, so they had too many kids. They spoke funny language and they dressed funny. They weren't Anglos. They weren't Protestants. You know, they weren't WASP. So throughout American history, I've observed that when the question of the immigrant comes, it's always been that of a threat. They bring violence and they bring drugs. And even before Trump, you know, this is something, they bring disease and so on and so forth. So I wanted to look at it differently and imagine it more that at the end of the day, those that immigrate here, for the Mexicans is different, is it? Because this was our land before. So I see more like we're like these homing birds that come back to the motherland. But in general, for all the immigrants that come here, generally speaking, I mean, there's some that are bad, but they come here because they want to live a life without violence, without poverty. So they're escaping something. And if this is truly a land of opportunity, then we should welcome them. And the ideas that they bring are really the ideas that make this country, you know, the most advanced country in the world. I mean, I don't like Elon Musk's ideas because it's a little bit off, but this guy is a genius. You know, that type of immigrant ingenuity to come to this country as an immigrant and create the Tesla and the SpaceX and all that, that is what America needs. The more Americanized you get in this country, as far as I'm concerned, you lose that drive. That drive that exists in the United States, it comes from immigrants because they're self-driven and they're a self-selected group. So you're talking about people that come here to take risks. You're talking about risk takers. So people that come to the United States take risks. And that's what you need. That's what we want. We want people who take risks, that are willing to create businesses, you know, to look at inventions and so on and so forth. You know, as a kid, as an American raised teenager, I was pretty much the laziest kid in the history of humanity. I mean, all I did was watch TV. And at my age, at 13, 14, 15, you know, you bring us the same kid from Mexico or Venezuela or anywhere in the world to come to this country, and they'll be working. You know, and they'll be waking up at 5 in the morning, they'll be working. You know, for my dad to just make me do errands is like, I thought he was torturing me just to rake the leaves, because I became assimilated and I became Americanized, and I lost that. I lost what my parents had, what my mother had, is that entrepreneurial spirit. So when I say reframe, I see, like, we have to see immigrants as like people on the move. And these are, they come here not to cause violence, not to take away jobs from white people. Not that white people want to be farm workers in the first place or want to clean homes like my mom did, but they come here because they want to make better opportunities for themselves, and not only themselves, but their families as well.
Yeah, Alvaro.
You know, so when they send money home. I mean, who does that?
Like, yeah, who comes to this country and sends money back home? Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but also recently we are seeing...
I'm getting all passionate.
No, you're fine. We see in the news now the huge number of people from Haiti coming here.
Yes.
So I just wanted to remind you that also... I like to use the word sometimes displaced. I remember when I came to the States, and my first thought it was, I don't want to be an immigrant. I came when I was already, I was 32 years old, and I had a study in the university and so on. So I really didn't want to have to do what you're describing, that people that come without any, perhaps a little bit of more formal education, which is considered a better qualification, no, to get a job and all that. But I think a lot about immigration as people that are displaced from their places, and also that they are born in circumstances that define their opportunities, really, to move around. So I imagine that you have been quite impressed also with what happened recently with the Haitians coming and being just almost automatically sent back to Haiti, a country that has been historically deprived from infrastructure and democracy and etc.
That's a really sad situation. I know that there was video of immigration on horses whipping them. And to me, like as a human being, I just can't watch that. You know, it's sad. It's like when Mr. George Floyd was murdered. I saw like a clip of the video, but I just cannot see the whole 9 minutes of it, or you know, the 8 minutes or whatever it was. And I see this more like there's no really difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. And a lot of times people think I'm a Democrat because I criticize Trump a lot and the Republicans, but you know, I'm an independent and I criticize everybody equally. Even the Mexican government, when they were bombing the Zapatistas in 94, you know, I criticized them as well. So the idea here is there's not that much difference in terms of the deportation or inhumane treatment of immigrants from Latin America by the Democrats or the Republicans. I mean, Obama, even though he was he is, you know, one of the best orators and the best in the history of the United States, you know, he deported 2.7 million immigrants. The majority of them being Mexican. So it doesn't matter if he loves his wife or he has two beautiful children and he's great. The fact that we have to focus on the policy, not the individual. It was FDR who put Japanese in camps, a Democrat. He didn't put the Germans in camps or the Italians, who were also fascist, but Japanese. And he didn't bomb Berlin, he bombed Hiroshima. So the problem that I see with Latin America, with the United States, is that the United States has historically been involved in supporting these military juntas, including in Chile with Pinochet, the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. And throughout Latin America, the United States has always been supporting dictators. In the 80s, when I was a student activist against U.S. intervention in Central America, the United States, they were supporting these military regimes that were killing people in Guatemala and El Salvador, Nicaragua. So these same people that flee because of U.S. involvement, just like we see people fled Vietnam because of U.S. involvement. So now they're coming here to this country. And then all of a sudden we're blaming them. Now we're victimizing them because they're fleeing poverty and violence that the United States was directly involved in. So it's this contradiction, this hypocrisy that I focus on when I write my social commentaries, is that on the one hand, the United States will argue, let's say against Mexico, that the Mexicans with the cartels and the drugs are a problem. They're a threat. Okay, I'm against the cartels. I'm against the Mexican government that is corrupt. But at the same time, you need to take responsibility to the fact that the arms that the Mexican cartels, the arms that they use are from the United States. So they purchased the arms illegally through the United States. So the United States were, I'm not going to say weak, because I'm not part of the government, but the United States produces more arms than any other country in the world, you know, probably up there with Israel.
You know. Totally.
So the thing is that, so there's that responsibility between that. And then on the other thing, you know, because I studied economics too, at Berkeley, there's a supply and demand. if America didn't have so many addicted, so many Americans who were addicted to drugs, and there's family members of mine too, so I'm not judging them, then there wouldn't be a big supply of drugs, right? So that is the demand that's supplying that is driving the supply. So America has a big problem with addiction, drug addiction. So instead of looking at itself and seeing that we have a problem and admitting that, it's easy to blame the Mexicans or the Afghans, because that's where, you know, heroin or opiates, you know, come from. So it's easier to blame someone else instead of blaming yourself. So when it comes to the drugs, the United States is complicit in that, because the drugs coming in from Colombia, from Mexico, from other places in Latin America, because they're feeding a problem that the Americans have. And the drugs and the gang and the guns that the Americans are killing themselves with, and my people, my state of Michoacán, where there's a big problem with that, where my parents come from, those are Uzis, and those are other that come from the United States and other countries as well, and not just the United States. So there has to be that responsibility. And it's easy to say, oh, these poor Haitians are coming and they're a threat. And it's easy for the Biden administration to just deport them without looking at what is the role of the United States that created those conditions to begin with, that is forcing people to flee. So I blame the United States and their role in terms of their policies against Latin America for a lot of this chaos. I mean, we see, like, in Central America, this is the last point the violence that exists with the MS-13, right, with the Mara Salvatrucha. Mara Salvatrucha was created in the United States. You know, the gang was created in MacArthur Park in L.A. And it was when they were deported from L.A. back to Central America. So they first came because they were children of the war, you know, that they fled in the 80s. They became gang members in our cities, in the inner cities, and then they returned to their countries, and then now they spread all over Central America where they're a menace. They're not a menace here because they're just a gang. They don't have nuclear weapons or anything like that. So let's blow them out of proportion. They're not even Al-Qaeda level, but they're a product of, they're American made.
Can I ask you one thing, and you can defer if you choose to. If you could just think freely, mm-hmm. what would you think about the idea of open borders, which drives so many Anglo-Americans into hysteria?
Right.
What is it about open borders that does that, and why would open borders be such a terrible thing?
Well, that's a great question. I'm open to most questions. One time I was with a right winger, this black Uncle Tom, that was asking me questions out of nowhere, like really, like trying to get me to say something that. I forget his name, Peterson. I forget the guy's name.
He wanted to know why you have an accent over your A.
Yeah,
Alvaro.
He was asking weird questions. I was like, but he was trying to get me to admit to something that typically I won't talk about. I think it has to do with this narrative where there's been a fear in dividing us, like black, white, brown, and even within black and brown communities, right? There's this fear of dividing people. It's like this menace. It's like the barbarians are, these brown barbarians are at the gate. And so only by having the gate are we protecting ourselves from them. Any white American, and when I say white, you know, my mother was white, my brother was white, not in terms of like European descent. Actually, probably my grandfather was from Spain because he had green eyes, he was light skinned. But any person who's white, and for me, if I go to Chiapas or Oaxaca with indigenous, they see me as white. So this whole thing about being white or brown, it's all relative. Right? But any American, And I've been to Mexico numerous times, and when I see, you know, white Americans and Canadians, when they go to Mexico in particular, because I'm not too familiar with too many other countries in terms of traveling, they're going to find that they're the most gracious, most beautiful people in the world, you know. And the poor, when you go to the poorer villages, they're even more generous. You go to any house in Latin America, not the elite, because it's different with the elite, because they act more, they have to, like, so it's a class issue. If they have one chicken, if they only have one chicken, they'll give it to you. And they don't even ask you, ¿tienes hambre? They just feed you. You know, so the whenever I've traveled Mexico, you're eating outside and provecho, like, or buenos días. In the United States, you don't have any of that. Like, if somebody says good morning, you're like, you know, what do you want? You know, you think like they're gonna rob you or something. Like, you get all stiff. You're like, you go for your wallet or something. But what I found is that narrative of the brown invasion of these people coming to take our jobs, you know, rape our women and all that. Same thing that was said in terms of, like, when an African American in the 50s was staring at a white girl, right? They were killed or jailed or beaten up or hung. It's all this fear that's fed in the minds of white Americans to think that these brown people are out to get them, you know, to cause violence or to harm them somehow. But when those Americans that are not racist, that go to Haiti, that go to Mexico, that go to the Caribbean, they travel and they love culture, like my hero, Anthony Bourdain, and they go and they taste other foods, they realize it's like, at the end, they were all human beings and they enjoy that, right? That we're not eating at McDonald's or this fast food culture of ours, right? That we're doing that. So once you start to go outside of that bubble and to see and get in, to be in contact with people, then you realize it's like they're not a threat. It's the same for us. Like I grew up with some black people or black friends. There weren't a lot, but there were some. So I was always cool, you know, because we're black, brown. It wasn't a problem. But I could see that growing up, if you don't have black friends, if you never met a black person, and growing up, all you saw on TV was, you know, like black people killing each other or killing others or being in gangs or all this negative, like dark image of them. I can see how, whether you're racist or not, consciously or unconsciously, you're gonna be afraid, right? But once you start to break that segregation and we're in contact with each other, or we meet each other from different nationalities, different colors, and all of that breaks down. But going back to your question, I see it more as that this false narrative that has been ingrained in the American psyche, that even brown people have also internalized. In other words, you have some people that are Mexican or Mexican-American that support Trump or are working for ICE or Border Patrol, you know, things of that nature. So they themselves have internalized that racism. At the end of the day, when it comes to borders, and I don't believe in borders, if anything, if you want to look at it more like on a very policy level, you know, I think like this idea of the European Union would be something good to implement, where they have, you know, countries from the continent that bring down these barriers. So there's trade, there's commerce, people travel more easily, people go back and forth more easily. There is regulation, so it's not like there's chaos or anything like that. So if the Europeans can do it, I don't know why we can't do it in Latin America or in the Americas. Like Bolivar said, you know, we're all Americans.
Thank you, Alvaro. And if you just have joined us, you're listening to Talking About California. I'm Loreto Rojas, and I'm here with my co-host, Carl Winslow. And you are listening KZYX, Mendocino Community, listener-supported radio. And we are having this very interesting conversation with Alvaro Huerta. He's a professor. He's an associate professor in urban and region planning and ethnic and women's studies at California State Polytechnic University. So, Alvaro, one of the things that I was, I think that is being discussed more and more these days, it has to do with the importance of telling our stories. I think they are famous phrases. So I think Mark Twain said that if you want to cure racism, go and travel, go to other places. Yeah, and many of us, migrants, immigrants, or displaced people, sometimes I am astonished of the way people talk to me, and I need to remind them that I have left my home country to come here, you know, because they kind of belittle you, you know, try to kind of put you in some kind of place. And I'm just like, well, you know, I have traveled from one end to America to the other. So we gain this experience and we are somehow more open to the experiences and to overcome obstacles and everything you have just described about Latinos. So, but I wanted to ask you to talk about this, about how important for us to break this this circle of stigma and stereotypes by telling our stories. What's the merit of that? Because I know you tell your story, and how important is that to change our society, our community, to change policies? What is the value of this?
I think it's very important. I mean, that for Native Americans, this is one way that they teach their young people. And they pass down their generations by storytelling. And this is how I started actually telling, writing, because I also write short stories. I learned from like the great Latin American writers, like Allende, you know, Borges and Vargas Llosa. And I would tell the same stories that I would tell. And some of those stories, they're funny or they're kind of tragic, but I would just tell them over and over to other people. And then I realized, oh, I'm going to write it down. You know, and so I started writing it down, and then I started sharing. And even telling a story, like when I met my wife at UCLA, and she kept saying no. And you try to tell stories that are universal, because, you know, people were like, oh, you know, like they're not Mexican, but oh, that happened to me too. Or, oh, yeah. So part of telling stories is you look for that universal aspect of it that brings us together. Or my brother, Salomon Huerta, is a brilliant painter. Like, he'll tell a story, he told a story and put on Facebook, you know, my father never said, I love you, you know, which he didn't. You know, he was like those old school guys, you know, that never said, I love you, never gave you a hug, or, you know, give you this cheap Mexican hug. Like, and when he said that, you had white, brown, black, Asian, like, comment, oh, that happened to me too. And, you know, like all this, like, it was like a therapy session. So by him telling his story, but he was saying it in a funny way, but he touched a nerve. And so it kind of like all of a sudden now you have all these other people, this community of people that come together around that. You know, same thing like with people that grew up without a father. I grew up with a father. He wasn't the best father in terms of being involved, but he wasn't mean to me, you know, but he wasn't like involved. But I see, like, I've met different people that grew up without a father, and they tell the same story. It's like you hear the same, like a pattern, like of them feeling like there's something missing. And then, so for me, I feel bad, you know, and I feel like empathize for them, and I don't want them to feel that way. So I try to help them or be there for them. So I think for us, I look at it more like how can we tell our stories like at a human level? And then at the same time, how can we tell stories that it might not bring us together. Like, so it's okay if we don't have that in common, but at least we understand, you know, where people are coming from. You know, so like, I'm not an immigrant, but I grew up, I have an immigrant experience because I came to this country when I was 4 and I didn't speak the language. Now that's different than coming when you're 13 or you're 20 or 30, it's different, but it's that experience that kind of unites us. So I have sympathy for that. So when I see that my students are struggling with the English language, whether they're Chinese or Mexican or whatever, I feel bad because I say, okay, I was there too. So I'm going to have more compassion, or I'm going to be more understanding. Or if I don't have that experience, you know, I'm a male, I'm not a female, but I do have four sisters, and I see that they have a different story that I cannot connect with. So, like, I don't know how it feels to go to a parking lot that is empty in the dark, because I'm not afraid. But if I was a woman, I would be afraid because of the sexual predators that are out there. So we have different stories, and by someone telling their story, then me as an urban planner, I can see, okay, you know, that we have to do something about that, because that goes beyond me. That it doesn't benefit me what I want to implement. It goes beyond, like, by listening to other people's stories, we can do something to make sure that it's a safe environment for people that are not like us. So it's about having sympathy, but also having empathy too. And overall, you know, we don't have that much time, but because of the way I grew up and the way I lived, I've always used humor as a way, like a coping mechanism, even against racism or people that have abused me over my years. And I've always, to survive, used humor. And I've found that also as a way of telling stories and using humor to kind of like put our defenses down and to disarm people.
Right. And also, I think the merit is that when we tell our stories, other people want to tell their stories too. I mean, what you were saying about finding common denominators, regardless of the story, somehow.
Right, definitely, and that is beautiful, right? So, because we hear different people's story, and we have the different, we appreciate that more, because we don't know what it is. If somebody grows up a Muslim in another country, we don't know that. We just know what Hollywood is telling us, how Muslims grow up in the Middle East. But by them telling the stories, that stereotype or negative portrayal is broken down. But we have to be open to that.
Oh, I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. I wish we weren't. Hopefully we can have you back again. And I hope it won't be, maybe it'll be before another year is out. I think we'll be anxious to hear what your work in Cambridge was all about and how that went. It's just always really nice to talk to you, Professor.
Oh, so, thank you. Likewise. Next time we should have it with tequila or something.
Sure.
have a drinking. Oh, we have two Zooms, one sober and one.
That's a good idea. That's terrific.
You have to come to Mendocino and have some that Zinfandel that is so famous, and Pinot.
Yeah, you're in wine country, so I really want to. The next session we have, it has to be in person because of the. This whole pandemic thing is under control.
You know, it's a long way in California. It's a big state, but you certainly would be found to be welcomed here, and we'd show you the town. Anyway, this has been talking about California, and our guest has been Alfaro Huerta, who's a professor in urban and region planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University. Again, thank you so much for joining us, Professor. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. We'll be back next week with another program in our series for Hispanic heritage. Until then, thank you again, and thanks, listeners, for listening, and good afternoon to everyone.
Goodbye. Muchas gracias.
Like we say in East LA, muchas gracias.